Welcome to the Joanne Averson podcast. In this episode, I get to interview Cynthia Allen. And Cynthia plays many roles in the world, one of which is founder of the Feldenkrais Move Better, Feel Better Summit. And one of the reasons I'm super excited to share it with you is that it's free and it's absolutely full of gorgeous ideas, brilliant practitioners, and people sharing from all over the world. Because like me, Cynthia Allen believes that the collective power of awareness, of us understanding each other's modalities, of us really appreciating different segues into experiencing our own embodiment, is part of a collective. It is not a competitive place to be. And as you will hear from some of the things that Cynthia shares in this podcast, we really share and honor the experience of opening people to all different kinds of modalities and appreciating this culture of collective consciousness. And it's all about our own inner awareness and how that guides us physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually through the different practices. And some of you will have heard the podcast from a couple of weeks ago with Neil Thies, who is the keynote this year. And I feel very honored to be one of the speakers there too. So join us, enjoy, and do join up to the Move Better, Feel Better Summit. It's completely free. What have you got to lose? Enjoy. So welcome to the Joanne Averson podcast. And it's my absolute pleasure today to have Cynthia Allen. Cynthia, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Joanne. It's really exciting to get to start to really explore with each other. So I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. And just for those of you that don't know and those of you that do know, to confirm, Cynthia Allen is founder of the Move Better, Feel Better Feldenkrais Awareness Summit. And she's also a partner in Future Life Now. Cynthia, can you just tell us what that means?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll start with Future Life Now because this is actually our 30th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
This year. It's our 30th year of business. My husband founded it. And so it started out as a neuro-linguistic programming practice. That is his thing. And then a few years later, I joined it as a Feldenkrais practitioner. I originally was in healthcare management and then made a big shift over to Feldenkrais. So then we became this kind of combination of somebody who works more with the mind directly is the beginning point in NLP does. And the Feldenkrais method sort of works as the entry point with body and sensation. But we're basically always trying to do the same kind of thing, which is to help people unravel these really deeply embedded, unhelpful habits or maps of their movement, of their thought, their emotion, of their sensation, of their action in the world. So it's very similar in that way. Now, you know, you guys in the fascia world have really had this big sort of awakening happening over the last 10 years, I would say primarily over the last 10 years, where people are beginning to be really interested in fascia. And the Feldenkrais method is very obscure, like you all were. You know, you all were very obscure in the beginning. I think you've done a great job of becoming more and more known, although I'm sure there's a lot of misunderstanding there too. Mm. And, you know, I saw the need for the Feldenkrais method to be better known. And I had already been playing a little bit with online programming. But when I saw how popular summits were 8 years ago, I thought, oh, I think that could work. I think it could work if we were to be collaborative with other groups of studies of thoughts like yourself, if we were to support each other as colleagues. And, you know, there's a strange thing that happens in the development of people.
Yeah.
And we just have become to the point in the last 20 years where it's not the kind of death grit competition where you try to put somebody else down while getting ahead, but there is this more collaborative growth where you can hold the idea that you and I could be perhaps competitive if we're in some way, but it's not a mean-spirited competitiveness. It's a competitiveness that helps us to connect more, to understand more, to reach out more, to support each other more. We don't see it so much as if I get support, that means Joanne doesn't get support. If Joanne gets support, that means Cynthia doesn't get support. So that was not how I was raised, and it was definitely not my modus operandi earlier in my career, but it was one I've really tried to embrace and grow through over the last 30 years. And in the realm of Future Life Now's existence, for sure, I've been trying to grow into it. So yeah, so then these Feldenkrais awareness summits actually took off, especially because of COVID, but they were doing well anyway. Mm. And I just love, we moved into the name Move Better, Feel Better, because we were trying to be more collaborative, and really nobody signs up for Feldenkrais because they don't know what it is, but they do understand the concept that they can actually feel better. They can actually move better. And that's what most people are wanting in their lives.
I love that. And I love what you're saying about collaboration, because I think we sing off the same hymn sheet with that. I started my own career more in yoga, and I was trained in work that followed Vanda Scaravelli's theme of working very gently with the body, listening into the body, tuning into the body, rather than following a sequence of postures as if you could cut and paste the same protocol over and over again. And Scaravelli's work was brought to the UK, several decades ago, 30 or 40 years ago. And I was very lucky to work with some of the people that trained with her directly. But my search was for the science behind this, what we could call feel better process. What was I hearing internally? And of course, now the developmental work of fascia and understanding it not just as a structural tissue, but as the largest sensory organ of the body, for me, unites the reasons why Feldenkrais works, why yoga works, why all these modalities work. Because let's face it, they all work. And what it is how do we find the one that works for us? And how do we respect that scientifically and sensationally and personally and through, whether you go in through mind or body or emotion, if it's all one, and let's face it, that's the spiritual side of all of this, if we're all one, how do we make that work? And I think your way of seeing it as a progressive, integrated collaboration between everybody speaks so loudly and profoundly for the era that we're now in. And your cast list, yeah, your curated cast lists for the summits are just, they speak of that. So I really appreciate that. So, you know, thank you.
Yeah. And it's a big thing for us in the Feldenkrais world. And I hope I've been a fundamental cog in the wheel of moving the way Feldenkrais practitioners think ahead. I mean, we came out of the training of Moshe Feldenkrais. Yeah. So you came out of different trainings with different yoga gurus. Moshe was in the era in which everybody was touting their own work as being better than other people's work.
Yeah.
And Moshe was bold about saying that. And he was also bold about this sort of I want to be honest about where he came from. And he was also pretty bold about putting down directly other works. So even though he and Ida Roth were actually good friends, he was very bold about saying, you know, Ida should have done something different. This I've got
love that
it takes. I'm just not. I mean, they were bold about this, he and Ida, in their competition. I don't think that it really stopped them from developing their work as far as they could, but what it did stop was it stopped the next generation from developing the work as far as they could, because they held on to that teaching. You know, your umbilical cord gets tied to these first teachers that are so influential in your life. And then you repeat all this stuff, sort of, you don't know that you're doing it. it's hard to realize that you're doing it, but you repeat it as if it's part of the pedagogy of the Feldenkrais method, is to keep saying the Feldenkrais method is better. So really, that was a struggle for me through my training. I would go like, oh, do we have to have this sort of edginess? And I thought my trainers were pretty good for the most part. They were not these really harsh ones. So do we have to have this edginess in which we have to put something else down? Because I'll tell you, it really is like a kaleidoscope, right?
Yeah.
So you dial up movement. Let's say we're taking the subject of human movement. And let's say you're even going to stay within the field of somatic education, which is a fairly confined field of things like F.M. Alexander, Feldenkrais method, body, mind, centering, those kinds of things. Ruth Yalon's Bones for Life. So you have your kaleidoscope, and let's say the kaleidoscope is focused on Feldenkrais, and then you just barely turn it and you go to Bones for Life, and then you turn it a little bit more and you go to body, mind, centering, and then you turn it a little bit more. You keep getting a new constellation, a new experience of what it means to be human, to be a human within the world. And you think that change was just so small. How could it? But it's huge. Just like when we're teaching a class and you give one cue and people resonate with it, then you give another cue and it's like, wow, what just happened there? It's just like you exploded people's experiences just by shifting the cue.
I love that. So, I love that analogy of the kaleidoscope.
Then now you go to yoga, and I would say yoga is a pretty big shift from Feldenkrais, and yet it doesn't have to be incompatible. You absolutely get different things with them, and if you know what you want, you will seek out a different body of work. Totally. And then if you go to physical therapy, again, it's not incompatible, but a pretty big shift, even though physical therapists may not feel it is. I feel it is a pretty big shift from the Feldenkrais method. But it's not a wrong shift. It's just we can acknowledge that it's a shift.
Exactly. And what I love about what you're saying, and I resonate with it profoundly, because as you know, I worked for many years with Tom Myers before anatomy trains was a known thing. And so I trained in AKA Rolfing, but it has to be called something else, because by that time, this whole principle that you beautifully point out between Moshe and Ida, if we can use their first names, that their friction was as empowering to the rest of us. It was part of the alchemy, I think, that the next generations were able to take. And now, you know, Tom Myers' work in anatomy trains, I was fortunate to do the very early dissections in that. And I was stunned to discover that the lines are lines of convenience. That Tom himself says it's a metaphor, but it speaks to what you're saying very poignantly. Because the anatomy trains are carved, not revealed. That's great, big, huge. And it was a huge shock to me when I discovered it. But I was standing at a conference one day, I think, with André Vlieming, and he was kind of pointing out that we now know more than the anatomy trains and we've moved on from that. And, and I said, hang on a second, André, just stop right there. Tom Myers cleared a clearing in a forest that none of us could see. And every one of us can stand there now saying, oh, well, we know that's a beech and that's an oak and that's a sycamore and, you know, we've moved on. No, we haven't. What we've done is, courtesy of someone brave enough, and I was very lucky working with Tom for the simple reason he brought in Moshe's work because he'd worked with him. He brought in Ida's work because he'd trained with her. He brought in Jim Oshman. He brought in all sorts of people. And this mixture that you're referring to is so powerful. And I remember standing there saying to André, André, we have the clearing in the forest because somebody was brave enough to argue with the paradigm of bits and pieces and move it into a paradigm of bands. That's what Tom did, right? But the body's not divided up into bits and it's not divided up into bands either, or slings. It's whole and complete. And Feldenkrais, and I was very lucky, my first yoga teacher's wife was a Feldenkrais teacher. So we had this delicious mixture and we trained at the Alexander Center. So we were kind of brought up, our teething was in a way open to the bigger family. And what I think you do, Cynthia, that is so powerful is you've basically said, what's the contribution to the alchemical pot that we're all mixing? Because this soup can save all of us. Now, everybody wants their own flavor. Everybody wants their own particular spices and herbs and seasonings and ways of serving this movement somatic soup, if I can dare to call it that. But where your service goes way beyond what you're doing is that it's so inclusive of everybody having the opportunity to observe these different trees that are now cleared in the forest. And I'm not saying Tom's the only one. God knows, everybody I know, and I'm lucky enough to be with John Sharkey a lot of the time, and actually doing the clinical anatomy behind all this to find out about this amazing fascia matrix that is non-denominational, that is automatically diverse, that is also a sensory organ, that makes sense of every single one of these modalities. You know, it's like it's the earth, it's the bound earth that all these trees are growing in this forest that we've cleared. But you have the grace to say, no, we're not just having a little corner of the forest where you've got a nice Kodak moment where you can go in and take a photograph of yourself as a Feldenkrais teacher. You're saying, come on, let's trek together across this diverse landscape. Let's make it an international park and let's invite everybody to go where they want to go. And I just cannot thank you and respect you enough for that.
Oh, thank you. I so appreciate that. Yeah. You know, it's such an interesting thing, really, because of course we do want to carve out who we are and what we have to offer and understand our own version of our purpose. And some of us are called to even take that to a step where we have a work that's named after us, right? Where we have an actual work that's named after us. But a lot of us are somewhere in between all that. And what happens when we're so busy protecting a piece of pie is what I think has happened to the Feldenkrais method, and we're very endangered. I mean, honestly, I'll just be honest. The Feldenkrais method is highly endangered at ending within the next 20 years. It's highly endangered because we held on for so long to our small piece of the pie, trying to control almost too much how the influences of other works, et cetera. It's just a really big conundrum for us right now in my understanding of where we're at. And so if in some small way, and I say that I think it's one of, of course I'm going to say this, but because I'm devoting my life to it, but I think it's one of the most powerful ways for people to explore possibility with significant injury and chronic pain that you will ever find. And so I feel that to not have a next generation afterwards is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. Maybe somebody else will pick it up. Maybe somebody else will do something different with it, but I feel it's a tragedy. So I think that it's really important that somehow we start to, you know, widen the field, not just to make that work more known, but all of these works that we're doing are valuable, again, someplace on the kaleidoscope, and need to be able to survive the sort of death of the human potential movement and move towards, which is where Ida and Moshe were born out of, is the, you know, as the human potential movement is when they weren't born out of that. They were practicing out of that. So they used the human potential movement as a vehicle to help their work become known. And so a lot of the language is within that understanding. But as we know, that's not quite as popular as it used to be. And in fact, I would say that it's coming back. Somatic right now is a very big buzzword, which is kind of nice, but also a little bit annoying because it's being used for, you know, workouts. I mean, literally, you could just get a basic workout and it's called somatic workout. It's nothing about, it's about the body for sure. You can put the word somatic on anything that has to do with the human body, but it's not what they were actually, what people are actually going for. People are actually going for this somatic education piece, which is so rich and deep in this sensory world and really engaging with the brain. So I want it to be, I want it to be us to be able to be known. And I hope somebody else can take that and do something with it. You know, it's a limit to what a summit could do for sure. But after every summit, there's an opportunity for speakers and for people who are exploring, the listeners, as you say, to find their match, for speakers to go, ah, what did I learn out of that experience? Who do I want to collaborate with, maybe? Did I even bother to show up and listen to any of the other speakers? Which is interesting, yeah. Too. Yeah, huge, right. So all of those things are in there.
And we were talking about this before we started the show. Sometimes I think the difficulty is, and bear with me while I describe this, we've become a culture of specialization. Everybody wants to specialize in the thing that they do, right? And I'm not criticizing that in any way. But if you think of a wheel, as everyone becomes more specialized, the spokes get further and further away from each other. And we don't all know what anyone else is doing. And I remember when Neil Thies, for example, first came on the scene, and there was a newspaper article, suddenly it was splashed all over the New York Times or something, about his work on the interstitium. And I think he's a genius. I have to say, I think he's a genius. But I remember the story of when his work came out about the interstitium, there was some seriously ruffled feathers in the world of the International Fascia Research Congress. You know, what is this? How come this has come through? What on earth's going on? You know, we've been doing this work for years and years and years and decades and decades and decades. And this speaks to what you say about, we can't help it. We become possessive about the pedagogy that we were weaned on, if you like. And there was a lot of excitement, but it was like, what's going on? And I know that John Sharkey actually said, you know, this is crazy, anybody getting upset in inverted commas, as if we're in a competition. This research is our lifeblood. Let's invite him. And from that conversation, Neil arrived at the International Fascia Research Congress. And since then, Neil wrote Notes on Complexity. And what he attempted to do there, I think, is what you're saying and more of. He took the whole kaleidoscope and said, how does the kaleidoscope work? And how do we integrate spirit and science? How do we put those two things together? Are they so separate? Because, of course, 400 years ago, and we're going to talk about this in the summit, we had a paradigm of mechanics. We were in the Industrial Revolution, and that was the metaphor, if you like, that we were all weaned on, including Moshe and Ida and us. We all learned biomechanics, right? Well, Neil, as a liver pathologist, as an international researcher, as a teacher, but also as a Buddhist, has somehow brought the science behind all of this and the spirit behind all of this together and made sense of both of them under the same laws of life. And that serves all of us in every paradigm that any of us are working in. And it's that unifying that I think we're all longing for, even if we're clinging to the rock of our own modality with fierce loyalty and intention. We're coming from the same place. How can I make the biggest difference in someone else's life? Because if you don't want to serve, you're not a therapist. Therapists are there to serve, right? So brave all of us, and however muddled we do it, thank you for bringing together someone like Neil at the summit.
Yeah, Neil's keynote for this year. We always have a keynote that is not Feldenkrais. We usually have one that starts off that is not for the Feldenkrais world and then one that is from Feldenkrais. And I'm so excited to have him. I think that, yes, we are called to serve and we're hungry to serve. But I think they're also the truth of that, Joanne, is that we're hungry for that connection within ourselves as leaders and teachers.
Well said.
And so, you know, that goes deep inside of us. And when we get too mired in a particular track of thinking, it starts to get dryish. Mm-hmm. Over time, it starts to get dry. So we need this connection back in some kind of way. And so anybody who helps us make that connection is phenomenal. You know, when my husband and I were exploring, together in Future Life Now, we did a lot of exploring with Ken Wilber's work. And what was at the time just absolutely revolutionary for us was that Ken Wilber said, hold it, you're all on the map together. Every single thing is on the map together. And in fact, there is an intersection here between all these things. It's just that you're looking through a different lens of life. And so if you look through the lens of how the internal person feels, senses, understands, that's a different lens than the researcher who's looking from the outside and going, what does the cell do here? How much weight can the bone handle? What's the tensile strength, the fascia or bone? That's a different thing than what did the person feel? What is the person's perception? And it's a different thing than what the cultural internal sensation is. Like the Feldenkrais world, there's certain words that trainers might say or teachers might say that everyone understands and they instantly deepen. And there is certain words like that in yoga that everyone understands and they just immediately go to some different anchored place. So there's even cultures that are that way. And then there are cultures of researchers. It's not just the research of the individual, but the research of the collective, again, from the outside in. And so I feel like Neil is, whether or not he ever looked at any of that work, doesn't matter. He's in a next generation because he's in a next generation, a whole lot more humble than Ken Wilber. So he's in a next generation of really trying to bring together those intersections and make them so it's not so far apart. A pathologist's life, if the pathologist stays with the cells flashing in front of them or the dissections that they're doing in order to get the slides, it can get dry. I mean, I know pathologists whose lives are more dry. And then I know pathologists who have added to their lives with art and music and, you know, as Neil has done, Buddhism or shamanic study or other things. So, yeah.
Well, exactly. And I think this is such an important part of what you're saying and of what he's doing. And who else have you got at the summit for us? Because I know we've got a whole variety of people coming and it's actually free to see everybody.
It's you, Joanne. We're so excited about you. And I can't wait to get into this, you know, discussion on bioemotional versus biomechanics. But we also have Edward Yu, who wrote a wonderful book on slowing down to go faster, tends to be appealing towards runners. And he's going to talk about how the biomechanics and understanding of that has started to limit runners. So I'm interested to hear what he actually has to say about that and how that fits in a little bit with you. And we had Julie Kasten Rubin, who was one of my Feldenkrais trainer educational directors. Oh, I had so many fabulous dreams about Julie during my training and some of the years after because she was so profound in her teaching style and her effect on me. And she's going to be doing a bit on Feldenkrais in a very practical way, which is how can the Feldenkrais movement help you with everyday things that you need to do, explore, and get into. Let's see, who else have we got here? It's so many people, it's hard for me to remember. We've got Roz Ori, who's actually leading a Feldenkrais training right now, and he's going to be getting into perception and how perception and the vision, the use of vision, self-image, perception affects chronic pain.
I can't wait to hear that. I can't wait to hear all of it, but...
Yeah. And Quinita Robertson, who has this wonderful background. She has a book called The Inner Ground Railroad. Oh my gosh, I love that name. And she has a book that she's going to be talking about grief and ritual and how we need to be able to dance between joy and grief and the ways that we do that need to be maybe reclaimed, maybe rerooted in some of our original backgrounds. So. Oh, and then for your audience, a lot of your audience would probably appreciate the fact that Jonathan Rosenthal is going to be here. He's a neurologist. I don't think it's a neurosurgeon, but he's been doing summits for the yoga field on research and just really delving into what does all the research show. So he's going to be going into it with us on some of the important aspects of research in yoga and what it's showing, which is so, so relevant. So there's a nice sort of smattering. It's definitely leaving people out that probably deserve to be mentioned. But I think we're going to cover just a really nice range of topics from pelvic floor health to chronic pain to this, you know, what is this thing of complexity? I think one of the things that's so important is that we can get really enamored with the complexity of the human body and the human function. And it can't become overwhelming to lots of people. Then we'll bring them into our classes. We have to have ways of exploring the body that are actually, and when I say body, I don't mean just the physical body, because your brain, your memory, I mean the whole thing. We have to have ways to help people explore that's simple, but still understands, at least the teacher understands the complexity, or understands that there is complexity. I mean, I don't understand the complexity, but I understand that there is complexity. So that when we get people who are coming out now with all these things about release the emotions from your hips. If you have tight hips, you have stored trauma. What a bunch of BS.
No, I'm right with you. I was about to laugh and I thought it might not be appropriate.
It's way more complex than that. It's way more complex than that. And there's so many reasons, for example, that people might have trauma. And there's also many reasons why people might have tight hips, that it doesn't have to do with trauma. So I think it's so important that we as teachers, where we grab on to a little piece of understanding, I'm just talking about me, and then I try to extrapolate it a whole bunch of different ways. I have to be careful with that because I'm not an academic. And I don't understand a lot of what, I won't understand a lot of what Neil talks about. And his parts of his book go, woo, right over my head, and then I come back in, and then back into focus, and then I go out. And so it's for me to suddenly start thinking, I'm going to use Neil Thies's language in how I teach and say I understand it. It's a mistake. It's a mistake. I have to find my own way. I can't just take pieces of Stephen Porges or pieces of Basil van der Kolk or pieces of Tom Myers. I need to find my own way that's authentic to me, and that is something that I can reasonably feel like, no, I'm pretty solid on that. I don't think I'm saying anything to that misleads people, that gets people thinking that there's something wrong with them when there isn't anything wrong with any of us.
God knows. I love that. And exactly, it's not just weaving together the spokes, but it's letting us rest in the weave and feel at home there. And you know, this is where I think the multidimensionality is what you're calling forward and giving everyone permission to experience. And in this day and age, and I wanted us to sort of wrap up on this note, that we live in this, it's a complex paradox in some ways. And I want to talk about it very simply. And I love that you described one of the original teachers that you worked with. Your whole body lit up. Anybody watching this on YouTube, your whole face lit up, your voice went up. And what came through, Cynthia, was the loving and the appreciation that you have for that, and that very practical, that very experienced process of learning with that person. And I think one of the things that certainly that I struggle with, because I've had to write academically, but I'm not naturally an academic. I'm an artist. And for me, life drawing, I'm much happier life drawing. And learning a hands-on bodywork means my hands speak fluent fascia. But then when I draw, it's as if my hand knows what it would touch, how touching what it's drawing would feel. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. It's the weirdest mixture of sensations for me.
And yeah. Almost a synesthesia.
It is synesthesia. And it leaves me so grateful when there's this multifaceted forum like the Move Better Feels Better Summit, where we don't just have to sit there internally arguing with, was that right? Did I need that science? I should have done that. And there's two things happening in the world. One is I'm finding a lot of people saying, what other modality should I learn? How many more therapies do I need? And what they're actually saying is, when will I be good enough?
They are.
And the answer is you already are. And one of the processes I think we're all in is finding that. And I think you said this before we got on, that we've got this paradox that suddenly we can all connect, we can all do online trainings and things. We've got no way of knowing the difference between some of them until we've bought them and done them. And so we can go all over the world. You're in America, I'm in England, and we're chatting away in real time, which in itself is incredible. But it also emphasizes how far apart we are at the same time. We're not together.
It does.
And this matters when you're teaching movement. And I had this crazy conversation with a neighbor yesterday. I literally went out to buy a few things, and she was outside the house, and she said to me, "How do you do your work online?" I said, "I'm sorry." She said, "Well, how do you do your work online?" I said, "Which work?" She said, "Well, you know, your body work." She said, "You do work online, don't you?" I said, "Well, yeah, but the work I do online isn't quite the same as the body work that I do. They're different, but they merge in some ways and they don't in others." And I just stood there thinking, oh my goodness. And then she said, "Well, can you take someone's pain away online?" And I said, "Well, having a movement modality means I can help them move better and feel better through a movement sequence. But I can't touch them and physically adjust them online. I wouldn't dream of trying." And I just sat there looking at her. I said, "What an amazing question." And then I said, "But the other part of it is sometimes just talking to someone, listening to them, and having them feel heard, everything changes when they've expressed that. What is it? This is NLP. If they've expressed an emotion that they've allowed themselves to feel, and suddenly it completely transforms their physical sensations. We can't categorize it all, can we? We can't wrap it all up in separate boxes because we are these incredible multidimensional beings anyway."
Yeah, we are. We are. And I'll tell you, one of the big surprises for me, Joanne, from the summit, I did not expect this. And then I was like, "Oh, well, of course. Why didn't I expect this?" Is that we reach people with more disabilities.
Wow.
Mental and physical. People that don't leave their house. People that can't lie down in a bed or on the floor. People who have been scared to be seen because of what's going on with their physicality. They don't want to be seen in a class.
Brilliant.
They're very touched by it. And very touched by, you know, I have had a couple different people who study with me over time, and they're, at first there's no camera on, and then there's a camera on, but you never see them. And then there's a camera on and you see a hand once in a while, and then a foot once in a while. And then you see the arm in the hand or the foot in the hand once in a while. And then there's a moment where they actually turn on the camera and they are visible either to ask a question or something. It's very touching.
Mm.
And so there are things we can do in online that we can't do in person because the person would never have come to
us. Got it. Brilliant.
And there's also something else that happens, which is the context for learning isn't in our private office.
Yeah.
But Moshe was really big about not having people take off their clothes because he felt that in his experimentation with his work, that when people put their clothes back on, they put their habits back on.
Oh, how clever.
Is it clever? Well, it turns out that I really see, and I think it's true. I don't think I'm making it up. I mean, it would have to be actually research. But I think it's true that people are learning the context of their own home and that the context makes it more likely for it to bleed out or connect out into their life, as opposed to the person who rushes to my studio, does an hour-long movement lesson, rushes back out to something else. Mm. And then the next week comes in and says, "Every time I come in here, I go, I'm here. But now they're saying that in their living room. I come onto Zoom. I hit the replay, however they're doing that on demand. I'm here. Sure I am. In my living room, in my kitchen, in this little space that I have put out in my bedroom to be able to try to do this lesson. In my recliner. I'm this woman who only does her lessons from her recliner. And there's actually quite a large number of people who do their lessons from recliners. They haven't laid in beds for years. Okay. I didn't know that. I didn't really know that was happening. And so it's a wonderful thing. And yet I also feel like the distance between us, especially between me and my family, or you know, people that I normally would have been really close to. We're such a mobile society now. We just had a death in the family, and we don't see that person maybe once a year, right?
Yeah.
And yet it's a very powerful death, but yet we only see them like once a year. So it's strange. It's stranger in many ways than if we did see them every day. And we really go, oh, they're missing from my everyday experience. So it's a wild time we're living in.
It is. And thank you so much for joining me and sharing this with me. And as part of that wild time, it will be my privilege to join you in May.
May 4th.
Yes, yeah. May 4th is the day. And the information will be in the show notes. And I'm just so thrilled. I can't wait to be talking to you on that day. Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Thank you, Joanne.
So there you have it. I did promise you that listening to Cynthia Allen would be a real treat, wasn't it? I do hope you'll check out the links in the show notes where you can just go ahead and join the Move Better, Feel Better Summit and download all sorts of fabulous free material. And if you want to dive deeper, there is an opportunity to upgrade, but all of that's in the show notes and you can read it at your leisure. There's no obligation whatsoever. I just invite you to enjoy. Take care and have a magical week.